Welcome back to the Roanoke Weekly Podcast for March 13th. We're a little light here, but we've got a stand-in guest host here with us. Matt, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So Mr. Matt McKimmie has been on before, but pleasure to have you back in the studio, sir.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, we are missing Ariel and Xavier today, but we still want to bring you the news from the past week, and we'll start with a really exciting note for some friends of ours, and that is that Northside High School won state championships for basketball. So,
woo!
Yes, very exciting. They've been in states, I think, the past 4 years, and they finally won it. And so a big shout out to the folks there, and those kids will have that to look back on the rest of their lives. So really exciting stuff, and the rest of us can live off the glow of those individuals.
It's always fun when we can kind of come together across normal intercity rivalries and celebrate one of our own that's made it that far. So that's fun.
Now, and an interesting news that I think is more important perhaps than we would normally think it to be, that it looks like Richfield Living has gotten permission from the Planning Authority and will likely get permission from City Council to go forward with their new property that's going to be on Orange Avenue in the northeast area of the city. It's going to be a fairly large development. They've seen an increase in the demand for assisted and nursing home living, and they're going to have a pretty substantial facility that will have a new traffic light out there on Orange.
Yeah, so this is about 2 miles from the Orange and Williamson Road intersection. So, I mean, that's a corridor we've heard a lot about in recent years, and so it's interesting to see this development that also will be creating an impact in that same area. I know that one of the concerns we've heard about that is definitely that's an area known for traffic, not known as a particularly a walkable or bikeable area as well. And so I think a lot of folks are curious about how this will impact that long-term as well.
Well, that was certainly my main question. And it was interesting to hear in the article, they mentioned that there's really no plans and it doesn't look like anytime soon that they're going to be able to expand Orange Avenue through that area, which is probably one of the few areas of the city that I would actually argue there's some need perhaps for some additional forms of transportation, whether it be improved bike lanes or whatever it may be, ride sharing. But just that's a bit of a sticking point in this community that doesn't have many of those.
Yeah, and they are planning to add another light, which, you know, if nothing else, adding a light makes it easier for people trying to cross during busy times, things like that. And that can help with managing congestion. But I think that's one stop in a long process that we know that, you know, the Williamson Road businesses, that there's a lot of conversation that's been going on around what the future of that corridor looks like. And so this will just be one more factor for them to consider as they're looking at what those future plans should be.
So now I wanted to take an interesting step and look at the kind of history and story of diversity in the area now from two kind of very different perspectives, one being a really interesting article in the What's on Your Mind section of the Roanoke Times about Daisy Schley, who was the first head of nursing at the Burrell Memorial Hospital, which, if you're not familiar with it, is an incredible story in and of itself, one of the first hospitals in the area to treat people of color. And she in herself was an incredible individual who came in and started an education program, did a number of other things, was involved in, it seems like, just about every organization she could be, and at the whole time was just an incredible advocate for the area. So I really encourage everybody to read this article in the Roanoke Times and just to take a moment to celebrate Miss Daisy Schley's legacy.
I think part of the story that's really interesting there too is that this is someone who came to Roanoke to kind of really take the next steps in her career. And so, this was early 1900s, a move from the Hampton area to Roanoke for this kind of a position. That's a really remarkable story just in and of itself, seeing how this area was growing, the type of talent we were attracting even over 100 years ago.
Well, yeah, and I also encourage anyone that's out there to look up the Burrell Memorial Hospital. It's apparently named after an individual who had to travel to D.C. to get his medical work done because there was no hospital in the area that would treat him as an African-American gentleman, and he died because he had to do that and was named in his honor. So just an incredible story that, and a look back at what things used to be like, and hopefully things are better these days. But again, there are incredible people here in Roanoke, and it always behooves us to be reminded that this area has incredible things happening in it. On the flip side, we know that there are conflicts around diversity in the police department. This is not a news story, but we are thankful to see that Roanoke County is making what appears to be a rather small step, but a step nonetheless to kind of increase and emphasize diversity in their police force. They're going to be having an event at the Criminal Justice Academy focused on that and really trying to ramp up their numbers for diversity. And this is given that 92% of the officers in the county are either white and or male. So a clear need there.
Yeah, I think that's something that we see in a lot of communities across the country as well, is that the police force does tend to be predominantly a white male profession. And that's an issue that a lot of departments are dealing with, trying to balance that diversity, but also help make sure that the law enforcement personnel reflects the communities that they're a part of as well. There are plenty of studies that show that the closer a department sort of mirrors the demographics of the community that they're in, the better those relationships tend to be.
Absolutely. And I would hope that this is the first step in this. You know, it seems like a very small thing for them just to hold a kind of speaking engagement about it. But I hope that it's a signal of their intentions to really make it happen. And it's not an easy challenge. I mean, there's challenges on both sides in terms of, you know, police departments have very entrenched cultures that are hard to sometimes get into. Whereas on the same side, in the African-American community, I understand it can be very isolating to choose to become a police officer. So it's just not an easy question to overcome, but hopefully there's a way forward there somewhere.
Yeah, one thing I'm not sure of that I would be curious to know is whether Roanoke County has faced some of the similar recruitment challenges that a lot of other departments have faced as well in terms of finding candidates who are interested. I know that we've seen that both in fire and police departments, that finding folks that are interested in committing to that kind of a career is an increasing challenge, and departments all over the country are having to be more creative in how they're doing recruiting. So I'm glad to see some of our local departments thinking more comprehensively about how they are recruiting new candidates to those positions.
Absolutely. So shout out to the Roanoke County for thinking about it and taking some steps to enact change. Speaking of changes, this will change my commute drastically to
many things. I'm so excited about this, Brad.
Including to the grocery store. But the Franklin Road Bridge is scheduled to be reopened on March 22nd.
Woo-hoo. That'll be here before we know it.
It will be. It kind of came out of nowhere that it's almost there. I happened to drive by it recently, and it does look very good. I don't know if you've seen the light fixtures and everything, but it's looking quite nice.
I'm so excited that for the entire time I've lived in Roanoke City, this bridge has been closed. So this will completely transform my experience of getting around town. I'm going to have to relearn how to get from point A to point B, and it's probably going to be faster in a lot of cases. So I'm sure that there are the communities and especially businesses that are affected by this, I'm sure they will be very glad to have that major thoroughfare reopened. If I remember correctly, I think the stats are that this is a bridge that's crossed something like 10,000 times a day. So that's a pretty significant amount of traffic. But it's also going to be exciting because they've improved bicycle and pedestrian access on the bridge. There's going to be a lot of public art, which I think it's always cool to see how the city is incorporating opportunities for public art into fixtures like bridges, and how that will be part of the celebration of opening the bridge as well, not just celebrating it as a transportation thoroughfare, but also as an opportunity for art and culture.
Well, yeah, and it's, I think that the increased mobility options question there is really huge, particularly in terms of the greenway running right underneath of that bridge. And so, there's a lot of opportunities for perhaps not directly underneath of that, but right there in the neighborhood, that mm-hmm. there's a lot of opportunities for folks now from Old Southwest and that downtown to get to the greenway easier from a different route that should hopefully open up all kinds of options, both running, walking, riding a bike, whatever it may be.
Well, and that the bridge also connects right there into that area that we're seeing so much growth there around, Earth Fair and all of the restaurants and Carilion facilities that are there in that part of town. And I think that seeing that there's been that much growth over these last couple of years, even with that bridge closed, I think that's going to be a really quite the economic boon to those businesses.
Absolutely. Now, in a different, I I think this is, you know, we talk a lot about the opioid crisis on here, and we still don't have any great answers to it, I think, at this point. But there's some steps being taken that have shown some progress. And one of the most interesting ones has been localities taking opioid manufacturers and folks that they hold responsible for this to court. And it looks like Salem has taken the first steps and hopefully moving forward on that. They've retained a law firm, which looks like it won't charge them anything until or if they win anything. And so they're going to move forward with figuring out whether it's a good idea for them to join the growing list of folks that are litigating the folks involved in this crisis.
Yeah, so this is a law firm that's working with over 40 different localities in Virginia. Obviously, this is part of a larger campaign that they're working on. And I think this is one of those sort of complex things. At first blush, you might wonder, okay, well, what standing does Salem have? What are these lawsuits actually about? And it's important to note that this has to do with things like making false claims, consumer protections, things like that. Obviously, the manufacturers thus far have denied all of these allegations, but that's sort of the basis on which these are being approached. That it's not just the fact that opioids turned out to be a really bad thing. It's that there were these, false claims, consumer protections that seem to have been bypassed in the process of marketing and distributing these opioids. That again, it's just compounded the problem. And so, at least, I'm happy to see that there's some level of recourse being taken on this. As you said earlier, I know that there's really, we're all still searching for that solution to the opioid crisis, and this certainly seems like it's looking back more on like what has happened rather than looking forward into like, okay, well, what can we do, to improve this in the future? So I would be really curious to know if there's some sort of correlation between, okay, all of these lawsuits, perhaps they win some settlement money. What's going to be done with that money? Can it be used in some way to improve the crisis overall?
Yeah. And that's, to kind of go back to that standing question, I think it is important to note that a lot of this comes from the increase in cost for social services, for emergency services, from things that have happened from this overdoses, children having to be taken out of homes, things that, this crisis has had massive ripple effects, and it's cost localities a lot of money to have to deal with it. And so that big question now does become, if you recoup some of the costs, what do you put it back into? Do you put it back into general fund, or are there specific efforts that can be made to make sure that this is something that we learn from and that we're mitigating future problems that come with it? So yet to be seen, but I think it's interesting. It'll be interesting to follow that lawsuit, and I'm sure the city of Roanoke County, all the rest of them will be paying attention to that process as well.
Absolutely.
And now to an article that I was one of the ones I was most fascinated to read, mainly because there's not a ton of data around it, but the big numbers are that the local lodging industry has experienced an 8.9% increase in hotel room demand over the last calendar year, which meant that there were 1.3 million rooms sold. Room revenue increased by $7.5 million, topping out at $112 million, a 7.9% increase over the previous year in 2017. All of this really interested me from a perspective of why. In the article, they lay out some stuff about sporting events, but it's really it's really unclear to me where exactly that number is coming from.
Yeah, so a lot of this is coming from Virginia's Blue Ridge, which is the local tourism bureau. And obviously, this is something that, from the tourism side of things, they watch very closely. Lodging is often very closely tied with tourism. People have a lot of out-of-town relatives coming to visit, but it's not 1.3 million rooms a year. And so one of the things that they point out is that they've been doing a lot more with bringing in sporting events and other activities like that. So the one statistic that stood out to me is that sports-related bookings were reported to be up 250%. Like, that's, like, as I think about sports-related lodging bookings, and I'm thinking of, like, Virginia Tech football games and all of these other, big events that often bring lots of people to town, to think about where that was a year ago and that sports-related bookings are up 250%, I think that's an incredible part of the story just there. Not to mention all of the work that Virginia's Blue Ridge is doing around outdoor lifestyle activities, mountain biking, the recent Silver Level Ride Center designation by the International Mountain Biking Association has brought Roanoke onto more mountain bikers' radars. I think there's a lot of good work going on there, and it's interesting to see a very tangible way that that's impacting the local economy through room lodging. If you think about the way that the ripple effect would work from there, if somebody's coming and paying to stay in a hotel, they're probably also buying food while they're here and perhaps gasoline and shopping and engaging in other activities. So this is just a little tidbit of that impact that the tourism has on Roanoke area.
Yeah, and it is a shout out to those folks that have really helped make this happen, from Virginia's Blue Ridge to the partnership and, you know, a number of other really cool agencies, including, you know, things like the Hampton Inn that have made this possible. I think part of this is probably just that there are more hotels available for people to stay in than
Absolutely.
There have been before.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about some of these big events that might fill every hotel room in town or close to every hotel room in town, as we build capacity in that area, you have fewer people that are staying in Lynchburg and driving in, or other nearby places that are maybe close enough to stay and make a day trip in. If we have capacity to lodge them here, that, again, benefits the entire local economy.
Well, I know that we can speak from personal experience, having put on an event where it was very hard to find hotel rooms about a month before the event. So,
yeah, I think you know, people who live in Roanoke might not realize how often we do have events going on that really sort of max out our lodging capacity in this area. Most of us who live here don't often have to interact with the lodging part of the economy, and it's really cool to see that that's growing and really thriving.
Yeah. Well, in a segue that I don't really know how to make, other than to say these were the two stories that perhaps intrigued me the most this week, was that there's an interesting note that the state legislature is going to allow medicinal marijuana to be dispensed in a number of different ways that it has not been dispensed in the past, including lollipops, lozenges, capsules, sprays, creams, and lotions. Apparently a large part of this is to help kids or students that need it, but are going to schools and then being facing penalties from the school system when they show up there. And so this is a way to unobtrusively still get it without showing up with your oils or whatever. But it is just interesting as we follow the state trying to figure out how all this works. And there's certainly a lot to learn.
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting parts of this story is that it seems like this is part of a larger set of laws and regulations that were passed recently that are sort of clarifying some of the initial legislation that came out recently about medicinal marijuana. You know, back in November, there were 5 dispensaries that were given licenses to cultivate and extract oil and to sell that to people who are registered with the state as eligible to use them. And as they've sort of gone through that process, it seems that they've realized, okay, well, there are a lot of clarifications we need to make. So the one example that you gave is that while initially the legislation might have sounded like they could only dispense it as oil, now they've clarified it can be dispensed in all of these different forms. They've also updated some of the legislation around who the sort of legal people are to engage with that, whether it's just the person who has been named as eligible for taking it, or whether there can be caregivers, or one of the examples they gave were school nurses. So oftentimes school nurses are asked to handle and dispense medication mm-hmm. on behalf of students. Medical marijuana is one of those tricky things that technically it is still illegal on a national scale, even though it's medical marijuana, even though it's been legalized in Virginia. And so there are a number of protections that they want to make sure they have in place for people like school nurses to, you know, if they are caught handling a student's medical marijuana lozenges, they want to make sure that school nurse has protection, that they can do their job to help those students take their medicine.
Yeah, so it'll be fascinating to see that. And as always, when these questions of medicinal marijuana pop up, I'm just looking forward to the point when folks in Roanoke don't have to drive to Bristol to get their supplies, because that's still a very onerous task.
It is. And it's, you know, I think that there's so many interwoven stories in this. I think, you know, when you look on the local level, thinking about everything from, you know, school, trying to protect school nurses and enable children to receive help from these medicinal opportunities, to the sort of the business implications of it. I know when we look at the medicinal marijuana industry and the marijuana industry as a whole, like there's so many question marks around like what the future of that industry looks like and investment and opportunities there. And as you know, even just in the medical marijuana field, as that grows, what business opportunities might arise from that for locals. I think it's one of those things where anytime you open a new field of opportunity, it's a great space for entrepreneurs to start thinking about what could this be like for me to be a part of that.
Speaking of opportunities and how sometimes they dry up from time to time, it is interesting. It's been interesting to follow the story of Deschutes and, you know, big entry, and now there's some questions about whether they're coming. And I'd encourage everybody that has interest to read the full kind of comments that the Deschutes CEO makes through on the WDBJ article, but really forthright about how they're just not where they need to be to make it happen right now. And part of that, you know, is indicated in the fact that they're not doing the street pub anywhere last year, and they only did it here in Roanoke last year. And essentially right now, the bottom line is they just don't know. They'd still love to be here, but the numbers don't make sense right now, but they don't know what they're going to look like moving forward.
Yeah, I think the story is actually a really great look into the bigger picture of how industries grow and change, and how an industry that's really booming at some time, and businesses that want to kind of stay ahead of that curve and really make the most out of the success of their industry have to make plans. But then as the market changes, you have to be flexible, and you don't, you know, as much as I personally would, you know, am excited about Deschutes being in Roanoke and the opportunities that may arise for them to build here in Roanoke. Full disclosure, I have several friends that work for Deschutes. I think that it's really refreshing to hear from a CEO just to be so transparent around, look, this is what the market is like. These are the business factors that we're having to juggle. And just being very real with you know, this city that they've committed a lot to already and really want to be here and a part of the Roanoke story. And I think it's for those who don't have kind of glimpses into the inner workings of large-scale business and having to plan so far in advance and make deals like this, I think it's, you know, I'm willing to give them some grace on this. I still hope that they hope that they come, but I am impressed by the way Deschutes seems to be handling this personally.
Agreed. I have very much the same feelings, and I just it reiterates for me that you know, Roanoke will continue to grow without Deschutes, but it's the kind of company that we'd love to have in the area if and when that opportunity becomes available for them. So fingers crossed.
And I think it's a good reminder that like this story isn't about anything that's wrong with Roanoke. Like, I think it's easy to feel down, like, oh, you know, Deschutes doesn't like us anymore. They don't want to come here. No, it's not about that at all. It's about these larger market moves that, you know, whenever you've got an industry that's really growing quickly and changing quickly, big companies that want to try to stay ahead of things, they have to plan ahead, and sometimes those plans have to change.
Absolutely. Speaking of changing plans, I have joked with some of my friends about this Arena League football team, or excuse me, National Gridiron League football team, which is an Arena League coming to Roanoke, just because we heard about it and then we didn't hear anything else about it. And so I guess it's a little unsurprising that they've postponed things and they're now facing fairly significant questions about whether this league is ever really going to get off the ground. But they were scheduled to start later this month, and now they're pushed back till May, it looks like. Supposed to be releasing a new schedule, but again, there are significant questions about whether or not this is ever going to come to fruition.
And this is an interesting situation as well, because again, it's, yeah, any time we hear these announcements like, oh, this thing that Roanoke got really excited about isn't going to happen, it's really hard not to take that personally, to let that affect our city morale. But again, this is a story that seems to have every indication that it has nothing negative to do with Roanoke at all. This isn't about us. This isn't about, you know, Roanoke being deficient or not being good enough. The league itself, like across the league, seems to be having real problems getting itself organized.
So if you were hoping to make your career as an arena football player, I'm sorry, but you might have to wait a little bit longer. Apparently there's another football league that you can try for. I'm not familiar with it, but it looks like my guess would be that we're not going to have one here in Roanoke in the short term.
Yeah, definitely in the short term. The article that I read said that, you know, that they have yet to pay their rent to the Berglund Center. Berglund Center is opening up some of those dates that had originally been reserved for this activity. So that's not to say it's not going to happen, but don't hold your breath.
Yeah. And when you are breathing, if you're looking for some fresh air, I would encourage you to check out some of the stuff that's going to happen at Explore Park.
That was a great transition there,
thank
Brad.
Thank you. It is interesting to note that there's more and more activity happening up there. There was a time, you know, when I moved to Roanoke, that Explore Park was kind of considered, you know, almost like a dead area. It wasn't a place that people went very often. Now there's tons to do up there in the WDBJ7 has an article which highlights camping, cabins, yurts, tubing, horseback riding, and this is all in addition to the hiking and some of the other activities that are already up there. And I think Matt and I know some information that we probably can't share about some other activities that may soon be available up there as well. So
there is growth in the works. So this is, to me, this is a really interesting story because it's an example of public-private partnerships. So this is, Explore Park. It's in Roanoke County. All of these opportunities that are being developed there are being developed by third parties. They're being run by, you know, organizations like Blue Mountain Adventures, Don's Cabins, and others. And it's neat to see the county use this resource that was being underutilized. That's how I might describe it previously, to kind of come up with this really great plan for how it can be activated, and then to start engaging with local businesses and dreamers and investors to make something out of that, and not just something for the sake of being something, but something that people really seem to be excited about. It's one of the things that I've missed, you know, thinking nostalgically about Roanoke is the loss of the Roanoke Mountain Campground as, you know, one of the kind of the primary local camping spots. If you wanted to go camping in a more developed area, but still close to Roanoke. And I think that there is some potential for Explore Park to sort of build on some of that sort of interest as well for people that want to go camping, but maybe, you know, don't want to rough it out in the back of, the Appalachian Trail. But want to have something like a yurt or a rental tent or a cabin, but still have lots of trails to have the river access and all of that. I think there is a lot of opportunity there, and I'm excited to see how that continues to develop.
It is, and I warned Matt I was going to say this before we got on there. I'm very excited about this. Very much intriguing and exciting to see these new developments, and I think it's a boon for the area and could be, moving forward, a pretty massive draw for folks and, you know, maybe not hotel rooms, but tourists that want to stay a little bit of a different way. But I have to say that I'm not a fan of the name.
Why not?
It just seems very generic to me. I kind of want it to be something a little more Roanoke specific, or I don't know.
I don't know. I kind of disagree. I like the name, like Explore. Like it's an action word. Like you don't just go there and like rest or sleep, or you go there and you explore and you're engaged. I don't know. And it's also very short, which is great for marketing purposes as well. Short and memorable.
Well,
if you have suggestions for what you, a better name for Explore Park, you can send those to Brad, and I'm sure he might start a campaign, but I for one, like Explore Park, so you'll have to try hard to convince me otherwise.
I don't care that much. I'm still going to go, but it is. I wish it were a better name.
Did you make it out there for any of the big activities they did around Christmas time this year?
I did not.
That's another area where they're really trying to, again, activate that area throughout the year, and they had a really great Christmas display and some Christmas market type things, local artisans, and it sounds like they're planning to expand that even more in coming years. And so that's, again, just getting people out there, using that area, exposing them to the opportunities. It seems like there's a lot of great work and great thinking going on around Explore Park.
Well, everyone should go to Explore Park.
Go explore it.
Yes, absolutely. Do you want to do our spotlights, man?
Let's spotlight.
All right. So I want to give a shout out to one of my favorite restaurants in town. I don't often get a chance to talk about food stuff because that's usually not my purview, but Athens Corner Grill, which I've always been a sucker for Greek food, and this in my mind is one of the best, if not the best, Greek food spots in town, and love the owners. They're always great to hear from. My wife and I order takeout from there at least once a month. And when my wife was pregnant, we ate there all the time. It was the one thing that really hit the spot, and it continues to. So Big shout out to Athens Corner Grill. And if you're feeling the need for Greek food, really encourage you to go down there and check it out.
What are some of your favorite menu items, Brad?
Well, so I'm one of these folks that orders the same thing every time I go to a restaurant, which is probably why I'm not the best person to do the food spotlight. But the hero platter for me, you know, it's hero meat there is just impeccable.
I seem to recall them having some sort of like a fried green bean appetizer. Does that ring a bell?
They do have something like that. And well, and there, I happen to know that their baklava is quite tasty as well. So just the right, not quite as sweet as a lot of baklava we find, which I kind of find refreshing. I think baklava can often be a little too sweet.
Brad, the baklava connoisseur.
You know, there are worse things to be connoisseurs of, aren't they?
That is true. Well, speaking of spotlights, I would love to do this week's arts spotlight. For this week, we're going to kind of take a slightly different tactic towards the arts spotlight and talk about the upcoming St. Patrick's Day Parade and Shamrock Festival that's going to be going on in downtown Roanoke. The St. Patrick's Day Parade, I remember reading or hearing at some point, this is one of the largest St. Patrick's Day parades on the East Coast. Yeah. So it's a pretty special event sponsored by Freedom First Credit Union. The parade itself begins at 11 o'clock. It'll come down Jefferson Street and Elm Avenue, then on to Campbell, ending at Williamson. So you'll... if you're there around 11 o'clock, I'm sure you're going to see people lining up for it. You know, park a little ways out, walk in. Hopefully we're going to have a beautiful day for it. And then there's also going to be other activities around the Shamrock Festival that are going to be going on all day there in that area, kind of behind the City Market Building, Salem Avenue. That whole block will be closed off. They'll have activities for kids. They'll have activities for adults, such as adult beverages. They'll have bands all throughout the day. I think those activities start at 10 a.m. and are going to run all the way into the evening, late into the evening in some cases. The Roanoke Catholic School is also doing a Shamrock 5K that morning and a one mile race as well. That starts at 8:30 at the Roanoke Catholic School. So lots of opportunities to enjoy the springy weather that has been coming upon us, and to go out and just enjoy a fun festival. A fun personal story about the Roanoke Shamrock, St. Patrick's Day Parade. This happened 3 years ago, just after I'd moved to Roanoke. Unfortunately, I'd come down with an awful case of bronchitis. I didn't get to go. My wife was walking in the parade with the local Greyhound owners group. We own a couple of Greyhounds, and they walked together in the parade as a bit of a spectacle. And so we had moved here from a much smaller community. And so when I was lamenting about not getting to go to the parade, somebody mentioned to me that I could watch it on television, which was just this amazing revelation to me, coming from a community that didn't have any local television stations, to be able to kind of lay there on the couch feeling sick and see my wife walk by as part of the parade. It was just this really cool introduction to Roanoke, in that, you know, here's a city that's just small enough that you can, you know, go out and immediately after moving into the community, find a place to plug in, walk in the parade, have a fun time, but also big enough that we've got great local media coverage that covers these kind of local events, and shares that with the larger community. So that was just, it's always a really cool memory that I have around the St. Patrick's Day Parade.
It truly is one of the days of the year where everybody comes together in the city in terms of, you know, whether it's to have a party or whether it's kids to do kids activities or people in the parade, that you can find pretty much anything for your taste in Roanoke on that day. And so it's I'm not one to go out partying, but I hear that the nightlife is pretty good and on that particular day. And so go out and enjoy yourself and have a green beer, but don't drink too much, or maybe do. Who knows?
At least balance it out with some corned beef or some bangers and mash or something like that.
Very good. Well, I'll give our final spotlight this week, which is the business spotlight, to Better Building Works, which Monica Rokicki and her team just do really incredible work in terms of promoting green building and making sure that if you want to do something for your house, whether it be an addition or just to measure the efficiency of your house now, or whether you're looking to buy something new and want to do that or even build something, they're right there with you and can walk through the process of making sure that that building is being done as efficiently and as best possible, which I think in the modern world we know is this a vital thing when we think about this. A, it saves you money in the long run, but also the planet needs us to be thinking about these things. So big shout out to Monica and the incredible work that they're doing with Better Building Works.
Yeah, I really appreciate the work they do, not only with new construction, but also with opportunities for remodeling. You know, Roanoke has a lot of opportunities for improving older homes as well, and I know that they do some work in that area.
Absolutely, and you and I as owners of old homes really appreciate that. So,
for sure.
Well, thank you, Matt, for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
For those of you all listening, please give us a rating and review wherever you listen to this, and it really helps other folks find us. But in the meantime, we'll be back next week, and who knows who you'll hear with me next week. But thanks again, Matt, and have a great week.
Take care.